Side 2. But Kitty was a beauty. She gave promise of being so when she was still a child, for she had large, dark eyes, liquid and vivacious, brown, curling hair in which there was a reddish tint, exquisite teeth, and a lovely skin. Her features would never be very good, for her chin was too square, and her nose, though not so long as Doris's, too big. Her beauty depended a good deal on her youth, and Mrs. Garstin realized that she must marry in the first flush of her maidenhood. When she came out, she was dazzling. Her skin was still her greatest beauty, but her eyes, with their long lashes, were so starry and yet so melting that it gave you a catch at the heart to look into them. She had a charming gaiety and the desire to please. Mrs. Garstin bestowed upon her all the affection, a harsh, competent, calculating affection, of which she was capable. She dreamed ambitious dreams. It was not a good marriage she aimed at for her daughter, but a brilliant one. Kitty had been brought up with the knowledge that she was going to be a beautiful woman, and she more than suspected her mother's ambition. It accorded with her own desires. She was launched upon the world, and Mrs. Garstin performed prodigies in getting herself invited to dances where her daughter might meet eligible men. Kitty was a success. She was amusing as well as beautiful, and very soon she had a dozen men in love with her. But none were suitable, and Kitty, charming and friendly with all, took care to commit herself with none. The drawing-room in South Kensington was filled on Sunday afternoons with amorous youth, but Mrs. Garstin observed, with a grim smile of approval, that it needed no effort on her part to keep them at a distance from Kitty. Kitty was prepared to flirt with them, and it diverted her to play one off against the other, but when they proposed to her, as none failed to do, she refused them with tact, but decision. Her first season passed without the perfect suitor presenting himself, and the second also, but she was young and could afford to wait. Mrs. Garstin told her friends that she thought it a pity for a girl to marry till she was 21. But a third year passed, and then a fourth. Two or three of her old admirers proposed again, but they were still penniless. One or two boys younger than herself proposed. A retired Indian civilian, a KCIE, did the same. He was 53. Kitty still danced a great deal. She went to Wimbledon and Lord's, to Ascot and Henley. She was thoroughly enjoying herself, but still no one whose position and income was satisfactory asked her to marry him. Mrs. Garstin began to grow uneasy. She noticed that Kitty was beginning to attract men of 40 and over. She reminded her that she would not be any longer so pretty in a year or two, and that young girls were coming out all the time. Mrs. Garstin did not mince her words in the domestic circle, and she warned her daughter tartly that she would miss her market. Kitty shrugged her shoulders. She thought herself as pretty as ever, prettier perhaps, for she had learnt how to dress in the last 4 years, and she had plenty of time. If she wanted to marry just to be married, there were a dozen boys who would jump at the chance. Surely the right man would come along sooner or later. But Mrs. Garstin judged the situation more shrewdly, with anger in her heart for the beautiful daughter who had missed her chances, she set her standard a little lower. She turned back to the professional class at which she had sneered in her pride, and looked about for a young lawyer or a businessman whose future inspired her with confidence. Kitty reached the age of 25 and was still unmarried. Mrs. Garstin was exasperated, and she did not hesitate often to give Kitty a piece of her very unpleasant mind. She asked her how much longer she expected her father to support her. He had spent sums he could ill afford in order to give her a chance, and she had not taken it. It never struck Mrs. Garstin that perhaps her own hard affability had frightened the men, sons of wealthy fathers or heirs to a title, whose visits she had too cordially encouraged. She put down Kitty's failure to stupidity. Then Doris came out. She had a long nose still, and a poor figure, and she danced badly. In her first season, she became engaged to Geoffrey Denison. He was the only son of a prosperous surgeon who had been given a baronetcy during the war, Geoffrey would inherit a title. It is not very grand to be a medical baronet, but a title, thank God, is still a title, and a very comfortable fortune. Kitty, in a panic, married Walter Fane. Chapter 9. She had known him but a little while, and had never taken much notice of him. She had no idea when or where they had first met, till after their engagement he told her that it was at a dance to which some friends had brought him. She certainly paid no attention to him then, and if she danced with him, it was because she was good-natured and was glad to dance with anyone who asked her. She didn't know him from Adam when a day or two later at another dance he came up and spoke to her. Then she remarked that he was at every dance she went to. "You know, I've danced with you at least a dozen times now, and you must tell me your name," she said to him at last in her laughing way. He was obviously taken aback. "Do you mean to say you don't know it? I was introduced to you." "Oh, but people always mumble. I shouldn't be at all surprised if you hadn't the ghost of an idea what mine was." He smiled at her. His face was grave and a trifle stern, but his smile was very sweet. "Of course I know it." He was silent for a moment or two. "Have you no curiosity?" he asked then. "As much as most women. It didn't occur to you to ask somebody or other what my name was?" She was faintly amused. She wondered why he thought it could in the least interest her. But she liked to please, so she looked at him with that dazzling smile of hers, and her beautiful eyes, dewy ponds under forest trees, held an enchanting kindness. "Well, what is it?" "Walter Fane." She did not know why he came to dances. He did not dance very well, and he seemed to know few people. She had a passing thought that he was in love with her, but she dismissed it with a shrug of the shoulders. She had known girls who thought every man they met was in love with them, and had always found them absurd. But she gave Walter Fane just a little more of her attention. He certainly did not behave like any of the other youths who had been in love with her. Most of them told her so frankly and wanted to kiss her. A good many did. But Walter Fane never talked of her, and very little of himself. He was rather silent. She did not mind that, because she had plenty to say, and it pleased her to see him laugh when she made a facetious remark. But when he talked, it was not stupidly. He was evidently shy. It appeared that he lived in the East and was home on leave. One Sunday afternoon, he appeared at their house in South Kensington. There were a dozen people there, and he sat for some time, somewhat ill at ease, and then went away. Her mother asked her later who he was. "I haven't a notion. Did you ask him to come here?" "Yes, I met him at the Baddeleys. He said he'd seen you at various dances. I said I was always at home on Sundays." "His name is Fane, and he's got some sort of job in the East." "Yes, he's a doctor. Is he in love with you?" "Upon my word, I don't know." "I should have thought you knew by now when a young man was in love with you." "I wouldn't marry him if he were," said Kitty lightly. Mrs. Garstin did not answer. Her silence was heavy with displeasure. Kitty flushed. She knew that her mother did not care now whom she married, so long as somehow she got her off her hands. Chapter 10. During the next week she met him at 3 dances, and now, his shyness perhaps wearing off a little, he was somewhat more communicative. He was a doctor, certainly, but he did not practice. He was a bacteriologist. Kitty had only a very vague idea what that meant, and he had a job at Hong Kong. He was going back in the autumn. He talked a good deal about China. She made it a practice to appear interested in whatever people talked to her of, but indeed the life in Hong Kong sounded quite jolly. There were clubs and tennis and racing and polo and golf. "Do people dance much there?" "Oh yes, I think so." She wondered whether he told her these things with a motive. He seemed to like her society, but never by a pressure of the hand, by a glance or by a word, did he give the smallest indication that he looked upon her as anything but a girl whom you met and danced with. On the following Sunday, he came again to their house. Her father happened to come in. It was raining and he had not been able to play golf, and he and Walter Fane had a long chat. She asked her father afterwards what they had talked of. It appears he's stationed at Hong Kong. The Chief Justice is an old friend of mine at the bar. He seems an unusually intelligent young man. She knew that her father was, as a rule, bored to death by the young people, whom for her sake, and now for her sister's, he had been forced for years to entertain. "It's not often you like any of my young men, Father," she said. His kind, tired eyes rested upon her. "Are you going to marry him by any chance?" "Certainly not." "Is he in love with you?" "He shows no sign of it." "Do you like him?" "I don't think I do very much. He irritates me a little." He was not her type at all. He was short, but not thick-set. Slight, rather, and thin. Dark and clean-shaven, with very regular, clean-cut features. His eyes were almost black, but not large. They were not very mobile, and they rested on objects with a singular persistence. They were curious, but not very pleasant eyes. With his straight, delicate nose, his fine brow and well-shaped mouth, he ought to have been good-looking. But surprisingly enough, he was not. When Kitty began to think of him at all, she was surprised that he should have such good features when you took them one by one. His expression was slightly sarcastic, and now that Kitty knew him better, she realized that she was not quite at ease with him. He had no gaiety. By the time the season drew to its end, they had seen a good deal of one another, but he had remained as aloof and impenetrable as ever. He was not exactly shy with her, but embarrassed. His conversation remained strangely impersonal. Kitty came to the conclusion that he was not in the least in love with her. He liked her and found her easy to talk to, but when he returned to China in November, he would not think of her again. She thought it was not impossible that he was engaged all the time to some nurse in a hospital at Hong Kong, the daughter of a clergyman, dull, plain, flat-footed and strenuous. That was the wife that would exactly suit him. Then came the announcement of Doris's engagement to Geoffrey Denison. Doris, at 18, was making quite a suitable marriage, and she was 25 and single. Supposing she did not marry at all? That season, the only person who had proposed to her was a boy of 20 who was still at Oxford. She couldn't marry a boy 5 years younger than herself. She had made a hash of things. Last year, she had refused a widowed Knight of the Bath with 3 children. She almost wished she hadn't. Mother would be horrible now. And Doris, who had always been sacrificed because she, Kitty, was expected to make the brilliant match, would not fail to crow over her. Kitty's heart sank. Chapter 11. But one afternoon, when she was walking home from Harrods, she chanced to meet Walter Fane in the Brompton Road. He stopped and talked to her. Then, casually, he asked her if she would take a turn with him in the park. She had no particular wish to go home. It was not, just then, a very agreeable place. They strolled along, talking, as they always talked, of casual things, and he asked her where she was going for the summer. "Oh, we always bury ourselves in the country. You see, Father is exhausted after the term's work, and we just go to the quietest place we can find." Kitty spoke with her tongue in her cheek, for she knew quite well that her father had not nearly enough work to tire him, and even if he had, his convenience would never have been consulted in the choice of a holiday. But a quiet place was a cheap place. "Don't you think those chairs look rather inviting?" said Walter suddenly. She followed his eyes and saw 2 green chairs by themselves under a tree on the grass. "Let us sit in them," she said. But when they were seated, he seemed to grow strangely abstracted. He was an odd creature. She chattered on, however, gaily enough, and wondered why he had asked her to walk with him in the park. Perhaps he was going to confide in her his passion for the flat-footed nurse in Hong Kong. Suddenly he turned to her, interrupting her in the middle of a sentence, so that she could not but see that he had not been listening, and his face was chalk-white. "I want to say something to you." She looked at him quickly, and she saw that his eyes were filled with a painful anxiety. His voice was strained, low, and not quite steady. But before she could ask herself what this agitation meant, he spoke again. "I want to ask you if you'll marry me." "You could knock me down with a feather," she answered, so surprised that she looked at him blankly. "Didn't you know I was awfully in love with you? You never showed it. I'm very awkward and clumsy. I always find it more difficult to say the things I mean than the things I don't." Her heart began to beat a little more quickly. She had been proposed to often before, but gaily or sentimentally, and she had answered in the same fashion. No one had ever asked her to marry him in a manner which was so abrupt, and yet strangely tragic. "It's very kind of you," she said doubtfully. "I fell in love with you the first time I saw you. I wanted to ask you before, but I could never bring myself to it." "I'm not sure if that's very well put," she chuckled. She was glad to have an opportunity to laugh a little, for on that fine sunny day, the air about them seemed on a sudden heavy with foreboding. He frowned darkly. "Oh, you know what I mean. I didn't want to lose hope. But now you're going away, and in the autumn I have to go back to China." "I've never thought of you in that way," she said helplessly. He said nothing more. He looked down on the grass sullenly. He was a very odd creature. But now that he had told her, she felt in some mysterious way that his love was something she had never met before. She was a little frightened, but she was elated also. His impassivity was vaguely impressive. "You must give me time to think." Still, he did not say anything. He did not stir. Did he mean to keep her there till she had decided? That was absurd. She must talk it over with her mother. She ought to have got up when she spoke. She had waited, thinking he would answer. And now, she did not know why, she found it difficult to make a movement. She did not look at him, but she was conscious of his appearance. She had never seen herself marrying a man so little taller than herself. When you sat close to him, you saw how good his features were and how cold his face. It was strange when you couldn't help being conscious of the devastating passion which was in his heart. "I don't know you. I don't know you at all," she said tremulously. He gave her a look, and she felt her eyes drawn to his. They had a tenderness which she had never seen in them before, but there was something beseeching in them, like a dog's that has been whipped, which slightly exasperated her. "I think I improve on acquaintance," he said. "Of course you're shy, aren't you?" It was certainly the oddest proposal she had ever had. And even now it seemed to her that they were saying to one another the last things you would have expected on such an occasion. She was not in the least in love with him. She did not know why she hesitated to refuse him at once. "I'm awfully stupid," he said. "I want to tell you that I love you more than anything in the world, but I find it so awfully difficult to say." Now that was odd too, for inexplicably enough it touched her. He wasn't really cold, of course. It was his manner that was unfortunate. She liked him at that moment better than she had ever liked him before. Doris was to be married in November. He would be on his way to China then, and if she married him, she would be with him. It wouldn't be very nice to be a bridesmaid at Doris's wedding. She would be glad to escape that. And then Doris is a married woman and herself single. Everyone knew how young Doris was, and it would make her seem older. It would put her on the shelf. It wouldn't be a very good marriage for her, but it was a marriage, and the fact that she would live in China made it easier. She was afraid of her mother's bitter tongue. Why, all the girls who had come out with her were married long ago, and most of them had children. She was tired of going to see them and gushing over their babies. Walter Fane offered her a new life. She turned to him with a smile, which she well knew the effect of. "If I were so rash as to say I'd marry you, when would you want to marry me?" He gave a sudden gasp of delight, and his white cheeks flushed. "Now, at once, as soon as possible. We'd go to Italy for our honeymoon, August and September. That would save her from spending the summer in a country vicarage, hired at 5 guineas a week, with her father and mother. In a flash, she saw in her mind's eye the announcement in August and September. That would save her from spending the summer in a country vicarage, hired at 5 guineas a week, with her father and mother. In a flash, she saw in her mind's eye the announcement in the Morning Post that, the bridegroom having to return to the East, the wedding would take place at once. She saw in her mind's eye the announcement in the Morning Post that, the bridegroom having to return to the East, the wedding would take place at once. She knew her mother well enough. She could be counted on to make a splash. For the moment, at least, Doris would be in the background. And when Doris's much grander wedding took place, she would be far away. She stretched out her hand. I think I like you very much. You must give me time to get used to you. Then it's yes? He interrupted. I suppose so. Chapter 12. He was extremely considerate. He was very attentive to her comfort. She never expressed the slightest wish without his hastening to gratify it. He was constantly giving her little presents. When she happened to feel ill, no one could have been kinder or more thoughtful. She seemed to do him a favour when she gave him the opportunity of doing something tiresome for her, and he was always exceedingly polite. He rose to his feet when she entered a room. He gave her his hand to help her out of a car. If he chanced to meet her in the street, he took off his hat. He was solicitous to open the door for her when she left a room. He never came into her bedroom or her boudoir without a knock. He treated her not as Kitty had seen most men treat their wives, but as though she were a fellow guest in a country house. It was pleasing, and yet a trifle comic. She would have felt more at home with him if he had been more casual. Nor did their conjugal relations draw her closer to him. He was passionate then, fierce, oddly hysterical too, and sentimental. It disconcerted her to realize how emotional he really was. His self-control was due to shyness, or to long training, she did not know which. It seemed to her faintly contemptible that when she lay in his arms, his desire appeased. He, who was so timid of saying absurd things, who so feared to be ridiculous, should use baby talk. She had offended him bitterly once by laughing and telling him that he was talking the most fearful slush. She had felt his arms grow limp about her. He remained quite silent for a little while, and then without a word released her and went into his own room. She didn't want to hurt his feelings, and a day or two later she said to him, "You silly old thing, I don't mind what nonsense you talk to me." He had laughed in a shamefaced way. She had discovered very soon that he had an unhappy disability to lose himself. He was self-conscious. When there was a party and everyone started singing, Walter could never bring himself to join in. He sat there smiling to show that he was pleased and amused, but his smile was forced. It was more like a sarcastic smirk, and you could not help feeling that he thought all those people enjoying themselves a pack of fools. He could not bring himself to play the round games which Kitty, with her high spirits, found such a lark. On their journey out to China, he had absolutely refused to put on fancy dress when everyone else was wearing it. It disturbed her pleasure that he should so obviously think the whole thing a bore. Kitty was lively. She was willing to chatter all day long, and she laughed easily. His silence disconcerted her. He had a way which exasperated her of returning no answer to some casual remark of hers. It was true that it needed no answer, but an answer all the same would have been pleasant. If it was raining and she said, "It's raining cats and dogs," she would have liked him to say, "Yes, isn't it?" He remained silent. Sometimes she would have liked to shake him. "I said it was raining cats and dogs," she repeated. "I heard you," he answered with his affectionate smile. It showed that he had not meant to be offensive. He did not speak because he had nothing to say. But if nobody spoke unless he had something to say, Kitty reflected with a smile. The human race would very soon lose the use of speech. Chapter 13. The fact was, of course, that he had no charm. That was why he was not popular, and she had not been long in Hong Kong before she discovered that he was not. She remained very vague about his work. It was enough for her to realise, and she did this quite distinctly, that to be the government bacteriologist was no great fry. He seemed to have no desire to discuss that part of his life with her. Because she was willing to be interested in anything at first, she had asked him about it. He put her off with a jest. "It's very dull and technical," he said on another occasion, "and it's grossly underpaid." He was very reserved. All she knew about his antecedents, his birth, his education, and his life before he met her, she had elicited by direct questioning. It was odd. The only thing that seemed to annoy him was a question. And when, in her natural curiosity, she fired a string of them at him, his answers became at every one more abrupt. She had the wit to see that he did not care to reply because he had anything to hide from her, but merely from a natural secretiveness. It bored him to talk about himself. It made him shy and uncomfortable. He did not know how to be open. He was fond of reading, but he read books which seemed to Kitty very dull. If he was not busy with some scientific treatise, he would read books about China or historical works. He never relaxed. She did not think he could. He was fond of games. He played tennis and bridge. She wondered why he had ever fallen in love with her. She could not imagine anyone less suited than herself to this restrained, cold, and self-possessed man. And yet it was quite certain that he loved her madly. He would do anything in the world to please her. He was like wax in her hands. When she thought of one side he showed her, a side which only she had seen, she a little despised him. She wondered whether his sarcastic manner, with its contemptuous tolerance for so many persons and things she admired, was merely a facade to conceal a profound weakness. She supposed he was clever. Everyone seemed to think he was. But except very occasionally, when he was with two or three people he liked and was in the mood, she had never found him entertaining. He did not precisely bore her. He left her indifferent. End of side 2.